Blog Talk Radio.
Self-published author.
Prepare for launch in 3, 2, 1.
They're out. They're out.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Out the Box, sponsored by Abercove Publishing. This is your host, Dion Hill, and today I am speaking with Terrence Witt. He is the author of Our Undiscovered Universe. Terrence, could you give us a little background on yourself?
Certainly. I started out in physics originally when I went to college. I've been probably a scientist since I was 6 years old, playing with bugs, getting the Tasco microscope for Christmas and the telescopes, and just I think some people are born to it. And so I had always planned on just going straight into to physics. And when I got to college, I kind of butted heads a lot with the way it was being done. And so I kind of changed gears and switched to engineering instead. And so I graduated from Oregon State University with electrical engineering degree, and took the job that was the farthest from Oregon, which was Florida, because the place I lived in Oregon had this kind of, we were stuck in this little valley and not a lot of sunshine. So moved to Florida, worked for some big semiconductor manufacturers for a while, and then branched out on my own in the biomedical field because I wanted to really do something to help people. And so I started a biomedical company, and then finally that was very successful. It grew and got too big for me. It was no longer creating things. It was more business and managing. And so I sold it a couple of years ago. But during the entire time, I've been working on theoretical physics and kind of trying to resolve some of the differences I had in school. And so I finally got what I felt was an abundance of evidence and overwhelming arguments, and published them with my book, Our Undiscovered Universe.
Okay. I want to announce for everyone, if you'd like to call in to speak to Terrence, the number is 347-237-4326. Once again, that's 347-237-4326. And I do have the web chat live, so if you have any questions, you can direct them and onto the chat, and I will give them to Terrence. Okay, so you've now basically changed gears in your life at this point, and you wrote your book on null physics. Can you tell us about that? Explain to us, what does that mean?
Well, what null physics is about is about connecting some of the early natural philosophy with modern empirical science. What happened is, thousands of years ago, we had very brilliant individuals that Democritus, for instance, figured out there were atoms 1,500 years before we could see them or measure them directly. And so we've got all these brilliant engineers in the Greeks, Lucretius, Democritus, that were trying to figure out why the universe is the way it is. What are the answers to the question, why do we even have a universe? And they scratched their heads and kind of came up to this big stumbling block, because they didn't have very good instrumentation back then, and so it kind of like ran out of gas, if you would. You know, all these questions became unanswerable. And so then we started this whole empirical realm a few hundred years ago, and where we measure and we build mathematical models of our measurements, and it's great for building steam engines or computers, but it doesn't really answer those questions that the ancient Greeks have been asking, were asked thousands of years ago. And so you can build a model of something that works really, really well, but it doesn't tell you why you've got a model or why the universe is the way it is. And so what null physics does is it goes back to the original questions that had remained unanswered, and it answers them. It has basically a global solution for these questions. And then that leads directly to a geometry, which then you can measure. So it connects these ancient questions like, why does the universe exist, to a geometry that you can use to measure the mass of a proton. So it's really, you know, kind of trying to open up an avenue physics is in a state where it's got the models, and then you build big accelerators like the one they're building in Switzerland, or have built and are running, but you're self-limiting to if you can't measure it, then you can't really talk about it, and you can't explain what you're measuring. So null physics is all about explaining the way the universe is.
Okay. Now, how did you develop this theory?
Well, originally it was incredibly difficult. I just kept asking better and better questions, and some the questions started even before college. And you know, there's times where science says, well, you know, this is they draw a line in the science, like, well, that's philosophy, this is science, and so questions like, why does the universe exist? Well, we have a model called the Big Bang, which says, okay, well, 13.7 billion years ago there was a big energetic expansion, but the model doesn't say, well, why was there a Big Bang?
Okay.
What caused the Big Bang? What really existed before the Big Bang? And so they draw this line and say, well, all those questions are philosophy, and what comes afterward is science. And I've strongly disagreed with that and fought to answer those questions. And so the first part, you know, I've been working on the theory about 30 years. First part.
I'm sorry, did you say 30 years?
Yeah, 30
okay.
years. The first part, the answers to the questions would span 5 years. I might work on something and make virtually no progress for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But then once I got some of the pieces, it's like if you've ever put a puzzle together and you're looking at the puzzle and you've got this box full of pieces, and the first part's terrible because you have no idea what it's supposed to look like. But as you put more and more pieces in place, it gets easier and easier for that to happen. And so the last 5 or 6 years of the theory just went at an incredible rate, where I have a new cosmology that I developed to replace the Big Bang, and I've got nuclear physics to replace some of the existing physics, and it's just going at an incredible rate. And I've actually got predictions, not unlike Einstein's prediction of the bending of light in 1915. I've got now very, very solid predictions that you can use to test the theory.
Okay, you know what, I need to back up for just a moment. You were obviously a very inquisitive child, and you're asking these questions. At what time frame, like in your life, did you, when did you decide that this was something, it was just a nagging thing, you know, that you had to get an answer to this? What was driving you? Like, at what point was this a true direction that you were going in, an unanswered question that you needed closure to or an answer to?
Well, it was something that, I don't know whether it's just brute determination or persistence, but I kept hearing all through, particularly in college, how there were so many places where science had decided that this question was not answerable, that we as a species, as humans, would never be able to understand certain aspects of the universe. And that's what I really bridled at. We had put men on the moon. We have deciphered, well, not then, but we have now deciphered the human genome, at least the sequence of letters. There's nothing that, you know, historically that mankind has been unable to overcome. And so I just, I just dug my heels in and was absolutely convinced that there were good, solid, rational answers to these questions. And it was kind of like the longer I worked on it, the more determined I got.
Okay.
And as it turns out, there were, when I finally got the breakthrough, it was literally like an electric shock. Where right now what science does is you've got all these observations and you measure them and then you create a mathematical model to describe them, but none of these things actually reach down to the geometry of which the entire universe is composed. What we see is just the stuff floating on top of the geometry, all these, basically like the shadow on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But when I first was able to do a calculation and actually reach to the geometry that the entire basis of the universe is constructed of, it was incredibly exhilarating, I guess you could say. And then after that, I was kind of hooked.
Okay, all right. Well, I was going to ask then what drove you, to write about this, but obviously you were hooked at this point, so I can understand that. definitely. What is the null physics position on Einstein's theory of relativity?
Well, Einstein wrote this beautiful theory that dealt with how we measure space and time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually shown that it's not really how space and time are constructed, but it's how space and time would appear to us. So it's an absolutely beautiful theory, and it's based on assumptions that are by definition correct. For instance, you can't tell the difference between being in an elevator being yanked up by a cable and being near some massive object.
Okay.
So when you have these austere, couldn't be simpler sorts of assumptions, then he built this beautiful theory out of it. And so what I actually use is in null physics, there are several places where I use the general theory of relativity to test some of the null physics predictions. So it is absolutely accurate as far as the measurement, but I don't think it is accurate as far as how space and time are actually physically constructed.
Okay. Speaking of the space and time then, what about the quantum mechanisms? How does that play? How does null physics play a role with that?
Well, quantum mechanics and quantum field theory and all these quantum theories are based on the fact that energy is discrete, so that if you look at the way planets orbit in our solar system, it's very smooth. You can take a rock and you can project it at a certain speed, and there will be some speed where that rock just orbits the sun, no problem. But when you get down to the atomic realm, things are different. Things are very discrete. Only certain orbits work, other orbits don't. And this is all based on the real fact that energy is quantized at a certain very small level. And so what quantum mechanics does is they built a theory based on this. And I actually use quantum mechanics quite a few places in null physics. Where I diverge is the quantum reality, where people have seen certain very strange effects, strange quantum effects, and they've interpreted those to mean that, the basis of reality is, say, irrational or...
What do you mean by strange quantum effects?
Oh, like the double slit experiment is, back in the early 1900s, it was funny, physics was kind of finished in the late 1800s. They thought all they had to do was dot a few I's and cross a few T's and we're done. And then all of a sudden they started looking at atoms, and it's kind of like a rubber. These things are doing some very strange things. One of the strangest things that they do is if you take a slit, it's called wave-particle duality. Is a particle a wave or is it a particle?
Okay.
Well, so if you put a slit in a plate, and you shoot a laser at it, you'll get this nice dispersion. If you put two slits, you'll get an interference pattern. You'll get bright, dark, bright, dark.
Okay.
So that the slits are actually interfering with each other, and it's just the same as if you were at the beach and you had two holes in some sort of barrier, and there's water going through it. The waves, if you treat this light as waves, then you get this nice interference pattern. But then there's this problem that, isn't light composed of photons? And so then you scratch your head and you'll go, well, if light's composed of photons, how can the photons interfere with each other? Because they're these little objects. And so then they did all these experiments, and one of the things they did is like, well, why don't we do this? We'll just take those two slits and we'll shoot the photons at them one photon at a time, and we'll space it out. So maybe every second we'll shoot a photon at those slits.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll figure out what's going on. And when they did, they got an interference pattern. And that's when they're scratching their heads and looking at each other like, what the hell is going on here? I mean, how could two photons going through these slits a second apart produce an interference pattern? And what we're actually seeing with quantum effects is we're not seeing that a photon is a wave, a particle is some sort of phantasmagorical thing. What we're seeing is that at a fundamental level, the atomic molecular level, information itself is conserved to infinite precision. And people like to think of, well, this is a random event, or we've got all this random noise in the system, but in reality, every bit of information, even a single photon striking the surface of our planet, that information is preserved. And so what happens is these photons move through these slits, and the entire system, whether these slits are separated by hundreds of miles, and each photon creates it leaves kind of a fingerprint, if you will. And so you're actually measuring how one photon affects the entire system based on how the other photon does. And so they actually can interfere with each other. And I call it quantum hysteresis, but you know, if you're just looking at these slits, you're like, oh, well, how is this happening? And then you draw the line and say, well, it's all weird, it's irrational, we aren't going to understand it, we'll just describe it with these equations. And so my whole gist of null physics is, no, there is a rational, logical explanation for everything,
mm-hmm.
including the presence of the universe.
Okay. Well, okay, then what we grew up learning was the Big Bang Theory. Why is that not correct, then?
Well, to start with, it's just incomplete. It's woefully incomplete, and it's logically inconsistent. You know, everyone says, well, what happened before the Big Bang? Well, we don't know. What caused the Big Bang? We don't know. One of the things that's really been sacrificed in science over the last 100 years is causality, the cause and effect. You know, the cause and effect that Newton promulgated, for every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. And so when you look in quantum mechanics, causality goes out the window because, oh, well, this, you know, this is just a probability wave, and something will happen, and it's not necessarily related. It, you know, is a statistical probability. When you look at the Big Bang, that's the ultimate, I guess, taking a break from causality, because we don't have a reason for why the Big Bang happened. And then the other thing is, the Big Bang's got a problem with matter and antimatter that no one really talks about so much. That if we did have this tremendous expansion, explosion, 13.7 billion years ago, where we got all this energy converted into matter, well, when you do that, in our modern universe, in our modern accelerators, you get equal amounts of matter and antimatter. So in the Big Bang, you should have had as much antimatter as matter. And in 13.7 billion years, you don't have a way or a mechanism to keep these two things separated so they don't interact with each other. And so in this matter-antimatter problem has been a problem for 70 years, and it continues to be a problem. And every time we try to measure some sort of asymmetry that's big enough to account for why everything around us is matter, it doesn't even come close for accounting that. And so there's an empirical problems with the Big Bang, the antimatter, and then there is just the logical problems of it doesn't really explain anything. And lately there's kind of a multiple Big Bang or repeating that was Fred Hoyle originally thought of, this kind of a cycle where it's a bang crunch going off forever, that there's always been some sort of a repeating process. But the problem with that is, okay, so there is a crunch and then a bang and then a crunch. Why is there a universe? That's really mm-hmm. the question. It's not, well, we had all these things happen, but, you know, if you tell a story about all these things happening in the last 13.7 billion years, you still haven't answered that question. Why do we have a universe instead of nothing? And so if you look at the philosophers, what they've done is they've basically taken that question and tried to show that question is not a meaningful question. It's kind of like, oh, that's an illegal question, or that question has no merit. Even though it's the same question that primitive tribes have been scratching on the cave walls since, and it's the same question that Einstein, Lucretius, Newton, all these gentlemen, the pillars, the giants of physics, have wondered about this question.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm convinced that null physics has an answer.
Okay. What are your biggest challenges for facing null physics?
Actually, the biggest challenge is just the kind of the momentum. Physics doesn't, it's highly political in terms of theoretical physics,
mm-hmm.
Because one of the issues is there's so many careers that rest on some of these theories. And so, you know, the last thing they want to know is that something they've been studying for 30 years is wrong. And to me, I enjoy finding a flaw in my theory. I think every time you find something like that, that's just an opportunity to learn something else. And so I'm gradually kind of working my way in, getting the theory out there. But in reality, if you look historically at every new theory. Now, the good news is, like, the Pope's not going to throw me in jail like they did to Galileo.
Okay.
So I've got that. And, in fact, if that kind of environment still prevailed, I probably would not have published my book. I would say, well, you know, I have these really neat discoveries, but I'm not really willing to cool my heels in the Pope's jail for a while. So that's the good news. The bad news is people are still almost as resistant to any sort of new concept. And so even though you say, well, look, I've got predictions you can test, they just don't want to hear it. It's like big bang, and repeat it over and over. In fact, the National Science Foundation, from what I understand, has a moratorium against really funding any research other than the Big Bang. And the problem with that is for one thing, it's uninteresting. If you don't have a discussion, if you aren't looking at alternatives and you're just kind of like making this, you know, trying to measure and trying to adjust all the data till it fits over and over, that's just to me an uninteresting and actually kind of a dead end. But if you look at plate tectonics, for instance, the continental drift, that's a good example of how easy it is to get new theories other than Galileo being in jail, of course. But, I mean, if you look at the gentleman that discovered plate tectonics, he was a marine biologist looking at fossils, I think, on the coast of South America and Australia, and he's saying, wow, these two coasts were once merged. I mean, finding exactly the same fossils. And so he came up with this idea that the continents were actually drifting apart. Well, 50 years later, that's 50.
Yeah.
The geologists rediscovered continental drift and gave the original discoverer of continental drift virtually no press time whatsoever. Didn't even give him credit. Just like today, you'll see some of these cosmologists talking about this repeating Big Bang crunch, Big Bang crunch, which is basically a rehash of Fred Hoyle's idea of a steady, quasi-steady state universe, and I haven't seen yet not one of these gentlemen give Fred Hoyle any credit for it. So I've been a little bit disappointed, but for the people that are truly interested and want the answers to the questions and don't want just another mathematical model or to wait for the next telescope or the next particle accelerator to try to answer these questions when we've got mounds of data we could be analyzing right now, it's been really well received.
Okay. You know what? This is a perfect time. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'd love for you to tell me, where are you? Are you teaching this someplace? You said it's being well received. Who's receiving it, and what are you doing? And then would you, give our listeners a little background into why you decided to publish this book and how you got started with it. But we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, you can call in to talk to Terrence Witt at 347-237-4326. And I'm also taking questions off of the web chat. So we'll be back in about 90 seconds. Bravo on taking matters into your hands and publishing your very own book. But now you're having trouble reaching your target market, right? Log on to Abercold Publishing today. We are the network dedicated to promoting self-published books and authors. Our goal is to feature your book on the Abercove platform while providing you with opportunities that could help you jumpstart a marketing campaign or enhance your current one with affordable advertising options and free bonuses from Abercove. The bottom line is, Abercove Publishing can help you get the word out about your book without wiping out your budget. Create a 5-minute book overview audio recording, host it by and post it on our website. We can help you get the word out. Want your growing target market to really get to know you up close and personally? Then check out our Blog Talk radio show. It's called Out the Box, with co-hosts Martha Kimbrell and yours truly, Dion Hill. We'll be sitting down at the round table to discuss issues that real people confront on a day-to-day basis. You already know that Abercove is about self-published authors, right? Then you'd better believe the hot topics discussed on Out the Box will come right off of the pages of self-published books. It's time to kick it up a notch and move your marketing campaign to the next level, self-published authors. Go ahead, log on to www.abercovepublishing.com. to see how you could become a co-host on Out the Box. Welcome back to Out the Box. This is your host, Dion Hill, and today we have Terrence Witt on the line, and he is the author of Our Undiscovered Universe, Discussing Null Physics. If you'd like to call in to talk to him, you can call in at 347-237-4326. All right, Terrence, if you could just jump right back into where we were. Tell me, is your theory being researched at this time? Is it being taught? Or how's the academic world accepting it?
Well, I think there's a couple places. I've finally gotten to the point where it's being reviewed here and there. The Royal Canadian Astronomical Journal was nice enough to review the book. A gentleman at Florida Institute of Technology was nice enough to review the book. And I think there's a couple places in the United Kingdom and Canada that are taking a pretty good look at it. And so that's really the first step, is get the book out there, get it reviewed. The main, you know, controversy, I guess, is why wasn't it published as a series of scientific papers? And then the reality is they're just that's just too long, too slow a process. The scientific journals are not really designed to revisit questions that are 1,000 years old, or questions that are basically have been labeled as non-scientific. So it's pretty hard to publish a paper about something that would be considered philosophy instead of science, or at least there's an argument about that point. So, and particularly, and the scientific journals are not about really publishing huge concepts. And so the book, it was clear that it needed to be a book. And then, and some other scientists, Julian Babber, for instance, published a book about time for much the same reason. He's trying to redefine time so that to get quantum mechanics and relativity to play well together.
Okay.
And so there are reasons it really needed to have a book. Now, eventually the next step would be at some point for it to be taught. But currently it can't really be taught when the students are in one class learning about the Big Bang, and then you go to the null physics class and you find out the Big Bang never happened.
Right.
So there's going to be, it's going to be a while before that gets taught. And but at the same time, what should be interesting is when some of the predictions, some of the big telescopes, the Big Bang's about 70 years old, and the antimatter isn't the only problem with it. And I think as our instrumentation pushes our view a little bit farther out, there will be problems that no amount of machination can fix on the Big Bang. Dark energy was invented to fix some stuff. Inflation was invented. There have been all these inventions to try to fit the data, but in reality, they still can't, you know, don't even address why there should have been a Big Bang. So at that point, this is just going to be a very slow process. What the main, motivation or inspiration I've got is from my readers. We have thousands of copies of Our Undiscovered Universe that have actually been distributed to 40 countries.
Okay.
And I've got some gentlemen that were either engineers or applied physicists or taught physics that have absolutely been thrilled with the book. And I've got a whole stack of emails of thank you, thank you, thank you for answering, for going back and dealing with these questions that have always bothered me since the first day I was in physics class. And so what we're really working is, it's going to be a grassroots effort until at the point where I'm actually on some place debating string theory or Big Bang cosmology on a larger venue. And that's gradually growing, and I look forward to that.
Well, at this point then, how is your study being funded?
Well, it's basically self-funded, the same as it has for the last 30 years. When I was basically in the infantry, I didn't have much funding, so
okay.
It was the college, you know, college bookstore and a very old and dilapidated computer. Now that I went through my biomedical experience, I had a research assistant who went on to get her PhD in astrophysics, And I've been able to, right now I'm probably going to start some sort of a group to chase down the predictions of the theory in cosmology. I throw the predictions out there to see who will step up to test them and read the theory. And I am going to be publishing some papers. I should have a paper coming out in about a month or so that doesn't mention the predictions specifically, but kind of like introduces the theory to the scientific community.
Okay. Well, let me just clear this. The company that you had started, did you then sell the company in order to continue your research?
No, not really. I had a management team running the company for the last few years that I owned it, because it had gotten to the point where it was all business, and I'm a designer. I like to create. I like to engineer things, and so our products were very, very mature, and we'd gone past the point where we're engineering. Now we're just in the market, and we're, everything's a business transaction. So I'd kind of stepped away from that in the last 3 or 4 years. That's when I was trying to get the book together and the discoveries together in some sort of cohesive form that I could really publish and show, basically show the world what I've been working on for 30 years. And so as that went on, then I also noticed that since it was all business, there were market forces that indicated that, the company really needed to be merged with a larger entity. And so that was just fortuitous. I would have continued on my research, and the company would have continued on doing its thing. And I would periodically step in and to some of the staff meetings and just slow the process down. And I'm not sure I was contributing real well. I'd review the decision and then pretty much say, yeah, you guys are doing the right things, and then go back to my computer. So, it was a really good fit. I found a company, Phillips Medical, that took incredibly good care of their employees and just an outstanding company. And so it was a really good fit. So I was willing to, let my baby go and let them take the reins on it. And they've done a stellar job.
Okay, good fit and perfect timing. I have a question that's coming off of the web chat. And I have someone who'd like to know, were you the target of criticism?
that's putting it mildly.
Okay.
I was amazed at the level of criticism I got, and it wasn't really so much from the physicists in particularly not working physicists or even teaching physicists. It was this whole group of kind of physics hobbyists and they looked up so much to the existing physicists, they thought that I was somehow insulting them or attacking them, and all of a sudden I went from a leader in the biomedical industry to a crackpot literally overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting, what I found particularly interesting, is these individuals would go on these forums, and a lot of the forums seem to be geared just for attacking people anyway, but they would go on for weeks and weeks without having read the book. They would evaluate, and then they'd have, they'd posit all these little theories and hypotheses about what was in the book without even reading the book. And that was what I found so spectacularly amazing, that it would be, I likened it to sitting outside of a movie theater and asking people coming out of the theater what the movie was like, and like camping outside of a movie theater for 2 weeks and asking people leaving the movie what it was like instead of just going and watching the movie.
Okay, right. You cannot write an accurate review on something you haven't viewed.
Right, exactly. And that's what, so just the fact, I just immediately discounted if, say, oh, well, that was a terrible movie. No, I haven't seen it. So that just has no credibility. They would like to parrot the current paradigms, like the Big Bang and all the details, and then they would quiz me on some of the details. And I'm not an expert on the Big Bang or on string theory or on particle physics. But I am very, very focused on logical consistency. So as soon as the fairies start singing at the bottom of the well, I kind of tune out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they would be grilling me on details of modern string theory, which is based on particle physics, which is based in quantum mechanics. And I've got a problem with what happened in 1914. So, and I tried to get that, I tried to convey that, and I tried to convey some of the simplest parts of my theory, that it was empirical, it's based on good science, it's got testable predictions, it's everything you want in a science, and really couldn't get a word in edgewise. It was pretty surprising.
Okay. Well, did any of them try to disprove your theory, or were they just attacking the theory?
Well, they didn't even know enough about my theory to really disprove it. There are certain, apocryphal things. Like if you come up and say, the Big Bang never happened. Well, that's a pretty provocative statement. And it requires the reevaluation of a lot of evidence that looks like it supports the Big Bang. And there it's compelling. Now, don't get me wrong, the Big Bang and some of these other theories have some evidence that certainly looks like there was a Big Bang. That's why we've got those theories. It's not like the scientists went out and just made up this theory de facto. I mean, we've got things like the cosmic microwaves and things like if you point a telescope around and you don't see anything much older based on how stars age, you don't see things that are much older than a few, you know, like 15 billion years. So there's this evidence that when you pile it up, you say, wow, this really supports the Big Bang. But in reality, the evidence has a perfectly alternate interpretation if you're willing to look at it. And that's where I found a lack of willingness to say, the universe looks like, it's like going into a forest and saying, this forest has been here 300 years because all the trees in the forest, as soon as they get to be 300 or 400 years old, they fall over under their own weight. And so that's kind of what happens in the universe. The reason why every time we look out there and nothing seems to be much older than 15 billion years is because the universe is a recycling process. Galaxies actually recycle the material of the universe, and the cycle time on a galaxy is about 16 billion years. It actually churns all that material back into hydrogen. And if I've got one more minute, microwaves is another example. If you look at a galaxy, and you measure the energy it gives off, well, it doesn't really give off many microwaves. It gives off a lot of light. Lights up like the Milky Way, you can see it. Now you get this bright band. And a galaxy is just a bunch of stars, like our sun. And so you've got all this light, but when you measure the microwaves, it's parts per million, tiny, tiny bit. But yet when you look in space and you look at the actual light energy that's in space, there's 10 times more microwaves than light energy. And so they say, if nothing's given off microwaves now, where'd all these microwaves come from? And so then that also says, there's this big thing that happened. But again, there's a perfectly good alternate explanation for that.
Okay. We have about 5 minutes left, and I've got another question coming off of the web chat. They want to know what you're working on now, and do you have any experiments that further the medical field or any other field with null physics?
Actually, what I'm working on now is null physics really hit a home run in the cosmology part.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, cosmology doesn't really help you drive your car to work. It doesn't help design new drugs. It's interesting. I think it grounds you. But what I'm working on now and what I've actually been working on, the book was really pretty much wrapped up in 2005, and then there was 2 years of editing and testing, and all the equations in it were probably tested 4 different ways. So since about 2004, 2005, I've been working on molecular and atomic dynamics. And what we have is quantum mechanics is really good at some things, but from my perspective, it's not very good at atoms or molecules. So for instance, if you look at a glass of water, all those water molecules in that glass have 2 hydrogen atoms. They're separated by 104 degrees, every single one of them. Quantum mechanics couldn't begin to be able to calculate something like that. Now, the quantum physicists will say, that's because it's just a computational problem that, quantum mechanics could do it if we had a strong enough computer. And unfortunately, that doesn't do us any good because we've got really, really strong computers, and quantum mechanics can't even do a very good job on a single atom if it's much heavier than hydrogen. So what I want to do is I want to have a simulation and an understanding of molecular dynamics so that you could actually calculate these molecules. So that if you could look at a benzene or in particular the molecules of which we're composed and say, okay, this is what that molecule's actually doing, instead of having to do some clinical trial where you try 1,000 different things and see which one works. So that's my main focus right now is molecular dynamics. And I'm making progress, but again, you start some big project like that and you spend most of the time learning everything that you didn't know or didn't even know you didn't know.
Okay. We have one more question coming off the web chat and just a few minutes left. I want you to let people know how they can reach you and, just give some communication information. However, there is one person who has a daughter who's a physics major at Purdue, and she wants to know how could you be reached, to do a lecture there.
Well, actually, the best contact, everything for the book,
mm-hmm.
goes through a website called OurUndiscoveredUniverse.com. And all the email contact information, phone number, a huge amount of information about the book. There are excerpts, there are podcasts, there's a little video that kind of does an overview of what the book's about. And so it's called OurUndiscoveredUniverse.com. And there's also another website called nullphysics.com, which will link, if you click on the blogs, it will link there. And there's a few blogs I've written that are mainly for humorous purposes, but they also deal with some of the, I guess, the political issues in physics.
Okay.
But all the contact information, they can forward an email or whatever. And we do get a lot of traffic on the site.
Okay. And the links to the blogs are also on Null Physics. And I'm sorry, the other one was?
I'm sorry, the main site is called OurUndiscoveredUniverse.com.
Okay.
We tried to get a shorter URL, but...
well, it works.
Yeah, it works.
Okay.
But if you just Google Terry Witt or Terrence Witt, it'll point to that as well. And if you want to know how bad a crackpot I am, and you Google that, then you can see... some of the amazing comments that are being made probably as we speak. But like I said, can't throw me in jail.
That's great. Well,
yeah.
We actually have to wrap, but this has been wonderful. And I see there's people who are very interested. So we'd love if, something happens, you can come back and talk to us again. But I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule today to talk to us about our undiscovered universe.
Oh, well, you're more than welcome. It's been fun.
Okay. And like I said, hopefully you'll be able to come back. This is Dion Hill, and we're signing off on Out the Box.